I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly biotechnology podcast that's not just about biotechnology. Providing information to help you change hearts and minds. Moving innovations to application with communication.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast, the weekly podcast where we discuss contemporary issues in science and technology, with a focus on biotechnology and new innovations that can help people and the planet. I'm Paul Vincelli, sitting in for Dr. Kevin Falta. Kevin, again, thanks for the opportunity to participate in Talking Biotech. It's always a pleasure. And today we're going to be talking about, we're going to be talking about, well, let's say it this way, a study that looks at the question of whether media sources from the Russian Federation may have some role in promoting anti-GMO technologies. And so I'm on the connection here. We have Dr. Sean Dorius from the Department of Sociology at Iowa State University. And Sean, thank you so much for joining us here on the Talking Biotech Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So why don't we start with, give the listeners some background as far as you as a sociologist. How did you get interested in sociology? And then maybe, how did you get interested in this topic of media influences on, or possible media influences on GMO attitudes? So give us some background.
Very good. So my background is in sociology, undergraduate degrees, graduate degrees, postdoctoral work, demography in sociology. And I have some applied and professional work in market research, working on the industry side of public opinion measurement and management. And then I work in sociology, largely in international research, comparative attitudes, and inequality regimes, looking across countries and throughout the world and how those are changing and how these kinds of ideas and ideologies spread around the world. So I did my work at my graduate training at Penn State and their sociology and demography program, a quantitative science training program. And then I spent 3 years as a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Michigan in the Survey Research Center and at the Population Studies Center there in social demography. So I have a lot of background training in surveys, but one of the things is we measure publics and we measure them with surveys. We see these sometimes changes in public opinion. The question becomes, well, what's causing those changes? And these days with the rise of social media, we've got this interest in the possibility that we can more finely measure how people's exposure to social media, to news media and other sources, how this affects what we're picking up in our social surveys. So that's kind of an area I've been interested in, is this nexus between social media and our traditional social surveys for measuring what the public thinks and believes and worries about.
Yeah, it's interesting to explore social media and the impacts of it on public attitudes. In fact, I gave a talk a few days ago in a county extension office on science literacy and in a digital world. And credible science really was the title, in a digital world. And one of the things that occurred to me, especially as a result of having read your paper, was, I said to the people that our social media empower us to, and the internet in general empowers us to find all kinds of really important and interesting information. It also empowers the people that want to influence us in some way, and advertisements or you know, or in this case, possibly, you know, other countries. And so, yeah, it's interesting that you have found this niche and seems like a fruitful one.
Yeah, it's a great area for research. I mean, for basic research, understanding kind of these fundamental mechanisms that drive changes in society and in our culture. And there's just a lot of moving parts. And certainly with the, you know, digitization and datafied world we live in, it's just an incredible time to test some old theories we haven't been able to test because we haven't had the data, or at least at the scale. So it's an exciting time to better understand what's going on in the world we live in.
Yeah. So the paper that, for the listeners, the paper that we're going to be talking about is entitled "Sowing the Seeds of Skepticism, Russian State News and Anti-GMO Sentiment." And it's in the journal GM Crops and Food, published this year, just a few months ago, as I recall. And it actually is an open access paper, so listeners can get a copy. Our intention is to have that website to directly link to the paper on the Talking Biotech podcast. So, all right. So maybe I've got questions about the content that I think are very interesting, but give us an overview of the paper, Sean.
Sure. So some background. I got connected to some of the geneticists here on campus at Iowa State. And as probably listeners know, that Iowa State's got real strength in biotechnology and genetic research, some of the leaders in the field. So it's kind of an exciting place to be related to biotechnology as a social scientist. Lots of interesting people to come and ask questions about what's going on in the world of genetics. But I got involved with this group and a collaborator in particular, and I co-authored in this paper, Dr. Carolyn Lawrence Dill in plant genomics. We got to kicking around some ideas and had some shared interest in understanding kind of why people think and what they think about GMOs and how that changes and what's causing people to be, say, opposed to or supportive of GMOs and biotechnology. So we kind of got to kicking around ideas over coffee, some projects we could get together on. And we wrote a small grant for some seed funds to do some work together, and got this and hired a grad student. And our interest was to test some methodologies. Could we glean some insights from social media that go above and beyond or enhance what we can see with social survey data? So our conventional measurement devices, the social survey and qualitative interviews, we know what we can get from those, and could we bring some new insights from social media analytics? And in this case, we ended up focusing on the media sources, the origin of messages about GMOs, news agencies, online news agencies in particular.
Yeah. And so I think it's probably important to point out to listeners that you do have your funding listed, and it is looks like entirely public sources: Iowa State University Crop Bioengineering Center and the Iowa State University Plant Sciences Institute Faculty Scholars Program. So I think, you know, given the sensitivities about corporate influence in this topic, I think it's important to acknowledge that your sources are public.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's the case.
Yeah. So, okay, so there's a bit of background in how you went into this. You know, in the introduction of the introductory portion of this paper, there was at least one, I've got several highlights, but there was one that I want to read to listeners and ask you to comment on this, because I wasn't even aware really at this level of what I'm about to read. But you right out of the paper, a quote is, "Russia is targeting Western democracies with an influence campaign drawing from a large number of seemingly unrelated social, political, economic, and environmental topics." So tell us about that. What do you know as a sociologist who works in this area? And tell us about some of the evidence in support of your knowledge.
Yeah, so this is an issue, certainly in the U.S. and U.S. media, we've been exposed to this idea of a Russian influence campaign since at least the summer of 2016.
Okay.
Intelligence agencies started to raise concerns that it seemed some of the data they were collecting, some of the traces they were following, that Russia was in the middle of an active measures campaign to influence influence the election. And more broadly, to influence not just the election in the U.S., but in the evidence and the research that's come out, influence the Brexit, for example, Brexit, influence in Spanish elections more recently. And it appears that these new media, and this is kind of, I should say, this is always the case with new media. When radio came out, when television came out, now with social media, these are ripe opportunities for propagandists, people interested in influencing and shaping the public and the opinions of the public. When these new technologies come out, they're ripe opportunities for propagandists to go bigger, to go bolder, and to test and to try new strategies. And that's exactly the same as we've seen historically with these older media forms, radio and television. We're seeing the same thing with social media, that it is a powerful and at present a very effective way to reach large audiences and to reach audiences at a very micro level scale. Russia seems to be doing that in a great many Western countries.
Yeah.
And based upon, I mean, again, we're kind of inferring motive, but based upon the target and the messaging, collectively, intelligence communities, both in the United States and in other Western democracies, the conclusion is that one of the goals seems to be to cause the public to question or to be skeptical or to doubt many of our central institutions, our education systems, our political systems, our criminal justice systems, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think what surprised me was, I of course, I'm following the story related to the possible influence in the election of 2016. But in reading your paper, that's when I realized, oh, this is a much more comprehensive and widespread phenomenon than simply the election. So yeah, so that's interesting to see. So so this particular paper that we're discussing today, you actually looked at the English language media emerging from the Russian Federation, right? So I think that's a really important point, is you were studying media that were really written for outside of Russia, you know.
Correct. Yeah, these are messages and media content designed for an English language audience,
which is us, you know, exactly. as well as potentially other bilingual people in other countries. But and of course the United Kingdom. So, one thing I thought it was important to say is that, you know, people come by anti-GMO or, you know, a skeptical position towards GMOs, honestly. I do want to acknowledge that. I do outreach on genetic engineering and get a chance to interact with very diverse audiences. The recent talk I gave was to master gardeners, and I also, you know, give workshops to university professors and everything, you know, across the spectrum. Anybody asks me to talk about this topic, I'll be there. Without any conflicts of interest either. I have no conflicts of interest on this topic. But people come by it, you know, with honest concerns. So the question really, I guess, that the paper brings up is, what is the role of Russian state news in possibly, facilitating anti-GMO attitudes or anti-GMO sentiment? But recognizing, of course, that people, you know, however they got there, they have legitimate concerns and questions. And so I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, certainly in my own research on GMO attitudes and kind of that larger kind of network of attitudes and beliefs and values that get related to these, you know, kind of where a person's particular position and beliefs about genetic modification, genetic engineering, where they land. Do they land in as part of their religious worldview? Do they land in their kind of their economic and kind of their capitalist or anti-capitalist worldview? Just land in kind of a natural or ecological worldview? Where these get placed really helps us to understand how kind of durable these are, how movable they are, and what their meaning is to individual people. Because GMOs have a little bit different meaning to different groups of people.
That's a very good point. Yeah. Can you give us like a sort of a brief synopsis of the methods that you used for the paper?
Yeah. So for this one, again, we weren't initially looking, we weren't interested in Russia. We weren't interested in a cross national or comparative. We were interested in testing some methods. And so we were doing a lot of exploratory work. We were looking at YouTube and YouTube comments. And we're looking at some online media and looking at user comments and trying to get an understanding essentially of what's being portrayed and how is the public responding to it. Comment sections is a nice one to see that. And, and along the way, we were also kind of looking at, can we, are we getting some sense that all of these comments are real or some of this kind of bot driven automated algorithms to look like human interactions? Is there kind of consistent messaging? So we were kind of looking at this. And at that time, that's when all this the news coverage about Russia was going on and potential influence campaigns. So we decided to look at RT, which is short for Russia Today, and did some preliminary analysis and said, wow, there's actually a lot of articles about GMOs coming out of RT, and started reading some of those. And wow, these are really one-sided, which was different than other news we were looking at, that there was strongly negative and anti, we would say anti-GMO, or softly would say very skeptical of GMOs, seemed to be a pattern. So our method was, we then set up a kind of a, again, we were on a seed grant. This wasn't a multi-million dollar budget we have, but we set up with our seed grant, we set up a small kind of a comparative study, and we grabbed two prominent Russian state news media organizations, RT, which is Russia Today, and Sputnik. And then we wanted to contrast those with U.S. news. So we tried to select, you know, with a small number, but across the broad spectrum of kind of political ideology in the U.S. So we have CNN, which is generally considered kind of mainstream. We have Fox News, which is a right-leaning news. And we had MSNBC, which is a left-leaning. And then we added HuffPost and Breitbart News, a left and a right-leaning digital web-based news media.
Yeah. And let me just interrupt and say, and I think it was very impressive how you diversified the sources you used from the United States. And really, to your credit, I think you've chosen a good range of media sources.
Well, thanks. So, and that was, you know, to give us some, just to maximize in a kind of a quick look here, maximize our contrast to see if we could find anything unique and anything different going on. So we got those websites, and a lot of the news coverage was that 26 was kind of an important year, and it gave us a nice, focusing on the year 2016 gave us a nice way to bound our study. I mean, with a larger budget, we'd have looked at more years and hope to do that in the future. But for this, we just looked at the 1 year, 2016, and we did a keyword search. Every article that referenced GMOs, genetic modification, genetic engineering, we grabbed all of those articles for each news website for that year. And then we did quantitative and qualitative analysis. The baseline we do, we call word scoring, and that's just counting how many articles are coming out of each agency and media source, and we can contrast those. And then we do the content analysis and try and get some sense of what are they talking about and what are the sentiments, the emotions that are kind of embedded in those discussions. What would a reader think or feel based upon their exposure to that article? And then we kind of aggregate those up so we get some scores for each of the news media. And what we found is that Russia talks more about GMOs than U.S. news agencies.
Across the board. They just talk more. Yeah.
So they're just, it's a more salient topic coming out of Russian state news than it is out of U.S. news. And then our second finding is when they're talking about GMOs, is by they, when Russian state agencies are talking about GMOs, it's far more negative than what we saw in the U.S. In the U.S. media, we saw a range of, you know, you'd have an article that would be positive, an article that would be kind of bring up the skeptical and the oppositional views, and then quite a few would kind of try and give you the pros and the cons. Here's what people for think, and here's what people are against think, and a more balanced view. Not that the issue itself has to be balanced, but the news agencies trying to make sure their readers and viewers are getting the full spectrum of views on it. And we just didn't see that with the Russian news. It was just, there was no attempt to show any positives of GMOs, any possible benefits of the technology. So it was really quite distinctive. It was really surprising to us.
So the Russian media, the RT or Russia Today and Sputnik that you studied, these are the predominant English language media sources emerging from Russia. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, that's correct.
And so, and are they, I think this is implied in your comments, but I just want to verify, are they affiliated in some way with the government, the Russian government?
Yeah, these are state funded. And And in fact, we mentioned this in the paper, but RT was just recently required to register with the U.S. government as a foreign agent. And that's kind of we just consider that a higher level of acknowledgement of its integration with state agency. Mm-hmm. There's like, for example, there's this controversy right now with ZTE, a big Chinese telecom that wants to sell phones and technologies in the U.S. and U.S. intelligence is concerned about that because the ZTE is really close with the Chinese government. And mm-hmm. so when those linkages with a private entity and a government are close, we get a little suspect and a little skeptical and have some mechanisms in place. And that's what's going on with RT as well.
Yeah. And of course, for the four sources that you focused on from the United States, CNN, Fox News, Breitbart, and Huffington, they all are independent of government. So that's a significant distinction. Yeah. So let's take a short break. We're talking to Sean Dorius, an assistant professor of sociology from Iowa State University. And when we come back, we'll continue to discuss the findings of this paper and what it means. And we're talking about the Russian state news, English news sources, and anti-GMO sentiment. So thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast.
Hi, Talking Biotechers. Episode 140 is important in that it emphasizes the importance of critically analyzing something very important. Our own opinions. We form opinions and thoughts from the evidence we deem credible. Sadly, that tends to be the evidence that's already accepted from people we relate to, the folks in our trusted communities. You sometimes hear social scientists think of them as tribes. But in episode 140, I talked to Mark Linus about his new book, Seeds of Science. Now, Mark was not certain about technology to the point where he participated in actively stopping it. To his credit, he stepped back, looked at the data, and changed his mind. The good news is that he sees technology with great nuance. He's no fan of companies and not even the rabid tech supporters, but he's a fan of technology that can help people or a planet. And this is the challenge to you. Listen to the podcast and challenge what you believe. Ask yourself honestly, what would it take to change my mind? And if confronted with that evidence, would I have the courage to change it? We live in strange times. I mean, the good news is that the way forward is easy. It's the truth. We need to test ourselves, challenge others, share beautiful stories, read Seeds of Science, critically evaluate Linus' claims, and share your thoughts on his thinking. The bottom line is that we have to constantly test ourselves for self-delusion and ensure that we are objectively thinking about data. Don't be anti-GMO, pro-GMO, be pro-science. Get excited about rigorous tests of claims and share that information. And read Mark's book, and for what it's worth, I bought mine online and I'm not being paid off by Big Linus. I just thought that I appreciated his sophisticated discussion of a topic that is immediately polarizing and polluted by mistrust. If we can talk to each other and, well, talk to ourselves about challenging our beliefs, maybe that's the best way to have a productive discussion and get this technology out to those who can benefit from it.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast with Dr. Sean Dorius from Iowa State University. Sean, once again, most interesting research. So, and we're thrilled that you could share it with us at the Talking Biotech podcast. So, what I wanted to come back with after the break was the issue of why this might matter to Russia, an anti-GMO perspective, because. Well, let me contrast this with several other countries. So I study what goes on in China with respect to genetic engineering. I've been to China. Their people are afraid of genetic engineering, but their government, and their government's not forcing it on them through their food, but their government is also very interested in this technology and really funding a lot of really good work in genetic engineering and related sciences. The European Union, it's the same way. The publics of the European Union are by and large concerned about genetic engineering, but their scientists are very interested in the topic, are very supportive of the wise use of these technologies by and large, and are generally publishing really good work, just like China in this area. But Russia, the Russian Federation, I would have to say, is, from my perspective as a scientist who reads the peer-reviewed literature, they are behind the curve. I can't recall seeing a single paper with a Russian scientist on genetic engineering or related sciences since I've been looking closely at the literature, which had been, you know, it's been 4.5 years. And you see this all the time with Chinese and European scientists as well as American scientists. We're really dominant in this area. And so, you know, to cynically, I might say, well, maybe Russia is, you know, is trying to affect the market for these crops instead of trying to dominate through good science. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. When we first kind of did this analysis that we talked about and discovered this really distinctive signal, we quickly began to kind of develop some hypotheses like, well, what explains this? Why would Russia be doing this? Is this a false positive? Is this a real signal? So we kind of threw a bunch of lines out to investigate some explanatory models. What would count for this? And one of them that we looked at was Russia's scientific background in biotech relative to the U.S. and relative to other Western countries, primarily in Europe. And to your point, it's not that Russia doesn't have any presence in biotechnology, but at least in the scientific literature, it just is orders of magnitude less significant than the U.S. This is an area where the U.S. is really, really strong. I mean, to your word dominance, it's just market dominance.
Yeah.
At the corporate level, but also at the scientific level, that these are two separate fields, overlapping fields, and the U.S. has just extreme dominance. And certainly that seems to be making Russia a little itchy.
Yeah. When I saw your paper and started to read it, I actually slapped my forehead figuratively. I was like, of course, you know, this makes sense, given the near absence, as far as I, you know, have seen the absence in the papers I've looked at, which is of course many. Are you going to publish that work on, you know, the citations, or is that going to be part of a future paper?
Yeah, I don't know. No plans at present. It was just kind of one of these things we looked at, and it's an interesting finding, but hadn't found a way to. If we can find a way to add it to some of the other work we're doing.
Yeah, I hope you do. So you in the break we chatted, and you know, there was some additional content and further research you guys have done since the paper has been reported, so or published. So certainly our listeners will be interested in additional findings that you can share.
Yeah. So we have done since then some additional additional analysis, and in part some of the responses to when we first drafted the paper and can send it out for review and for feedback. One of the dominant questions: well, this is all interesting, but what's the effect? Has it had an effect? Has this influence campaign, has it actually influenced the public? Has it changed public opinion? And in the paper that we've been discussing, we didn't take that question on. We didn't look at the effects. We just looked at the causal mechanism, which is this exposure to messaging. So we have done a little work to look beyond that, to look at, to try and get some evidence of whether there's this influence campaign's having an effect. And along the way, we analyzed a number of YouTube channels, RT's YouTube channel. We contrasted that with Al Jazeera's YouTube channel. That's a state-run media agency out of the Middle East, news agency. And we contrasted those two against the CNN. In the same manner, we looked at all the YouTube channels that have, or YouTube videos that have any GMO content. We analyzed those both qualitatively, watched all those videos, and then we used machine learning and some automation to analyze the text content of all those videos as well. And we got the same finding. What we saw on digital media is the same as on their video channels, and that's RT is strongly negative on their portrayal of GMOs, but even more distinctive on YouTube than on their print media or their digital media.
Interesting.
Was this a very strong anti-Monsanto. Wow. In fact, we looked at, for that study, we just looked at the top 50 most viewed videos on each channel that were about GMOs. And of the top 50 most viewed on RT, every one of them referenced Monsanto.
In a negative way, I see.
And in a negative way, yeah. So yeah. Monsanto certainly certainly for the propaganda side of Russia's messaging machine on GMOs, I mean, Monsanto is definitely the tip of the spear. They have decided that that's an effective weapon, and they're using it extensively.
Yeah, and I think it's I can safely say, representing both of us, that we're not here, you know, having this conversation to defend Monsanto. Your paper certainly isn't in any way about that either. But Monsanto has certainly been the dominant company in the use of genetic engineering for crop improvement, and so if you want to go after this technology, that would be the company you would target.
One of the ways that we look at it is we like to know, well, if people are exposed to this messaging, say they're on YouTube and they see a video, an RT video about GMOs, or they happen to get, you know, on their Twitter feed, an article comes across, one of these that we've talked about and analyzed, does that influence people? One of the ways we suspect that we could pick up a signal there is if people read something and they learn something new, like one of the common tropes in the Russia's portrayal of GMOs is this idea that the introduction of GMOs in India led to this explosion in suicides among Indian farmers.
Yeah.
And that trope comes up regularly in Russian portrayal of GMOs. That's a story that gets told more than once.
Oh, yeah.
It's all retold. So if someone never heard that story, they read a news article, we suspect that they would go to the internet and do some internet searching to learn more. Is this true, or what are the facts, and when did this start, and what's happening? So we've done some computational work to look at, to analyze internet searches about GMOs. So when people put in a search term, for example, one of them we looked at is when people do a search term, do GMOs cause, or do GMOs, what are the next things that they search for? What are the questions they ask? Mm-hmm. And for example, with the most frequent searches about GMOs, do GMOs cause cancer? Do GMOs cause allergies? Do they cause autism? Do they kill bees? Do they affect health? Do they cause infertility, antibiotic resistance? Mm-hmm. These are all the top searches in the U.S. and throughout the world for GMOs. So when people are searching about GMOs, they're largely searching about the negative portrayals of GMOs.
I see.
And when we look at the timing of those searches, we are seeing some patterning in the searches, that the search traffic has seen a sharp uptick since about 2011. From 2011 to about 2013, a real strong uptick in searches about GMOs. So we are seeing some behavioral response from the public based upon the messaging that they're being exposed to.
So but can we relate that uptick to the Russian news sources, or is it, you know, could it be other influences?
Yeah, it could be other. That's at the present, perhaps our most difficult, is to separate out a unique effect of Russia's messaging versus all of the other messaging.
Right.
There's all those organizations that are skeptical or opposed to GMOs that have regular messaging. There's all the industry, for example, industry side and associations that are supportive and have messaging and marketing campaigns. So the public is exposed to a myriad of messages, and separating out the unique effects of one or the other is really difficult.
Yeah, well, that's certainly easy to imagine why that would be so difficult. So you used a phrase to wedge issue in your paper, and that GMOs are a wedge issue. And I thought that was important because I've been most sort of noted the potential economic effect, you know, of this kind of effort by the Russian Federation. But in addition, there's some degree of social impact because, you know, GMOs are becoming like climate change almost. It's in the sense of, you know, what you believe depends on what your team thinks, you know, the social group that you identify with. And the same is true both in, it's certainly true in the U.S., but also the GMOs can be a wedge issue, or perceived as a wedge issue, between the U.S. and its European Union allies. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly the way that Russia portrays GMOs, it's clear that there is an interest to further separate the U.S. from its European allies. Mm. I mean, overwhelmingly, the portrayal of GMOs by Russian state news in their digital news. Overwhelmingly, it was in 2016 framed around the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade Partnership, and that was a big trade deal and being negotiated with between the Obama administration and the EU that was going to bring those two markets very close to an open free trade market. Mm-hmm. And that messaging, I mean, one of the things around that was it was GMOs were brought to light as an intent to turn the public against that trade deal.
Wow.
And the argument was, one of the central arguments in the messaging was, if this deal is signed, then the monopolistic kind of corporate agriculture in the U.S. is going to be forced on European markets, and it's going to destroy all of these premium local European brands. So it was framed as this large kind of monopolistic corporate endeavor in the U.S. was going to destroy local indigenous, like I say, particularly these premium food brands that have been around for decades and even hundreds of years throughout Europe. And so that was a really effective wedge issue. And that's that deal is dead in the water.
So it was perceived as a threat to the food culture of, you know, countries with a long history of, you know, proud food culture. So
Exactly.
Interesting, man. That's something. Seems to have been effective. When I saw this paper again, I figuratively slapped my forehead, and in a way it was a relief because I don't like to think of myself as a conspiracy theorist, but I don't think we are. I think the paper is what it is. It just stands on its own and, you know, speaks for itself. Well, I think it's really interesting. Let me give you one more quote to and solicit your comment. The threat of Russia's disinformation campaign is not limited to sowing seeds of division in the U.S. and bolstering Russian economic power. There is also the potential to erode public trust in science. Boy, that hurts. And that's my comment, folks, a parenthetic comment. But there is also the potential to erode public trust in science, an institutionalized pillar of Western intellectual tradition. And I think we see that happening. I'm talking from personal experience.
Yeah, that was as I got into this project, one of my interests prior to this project and ongoing is this, the public's perception of scientific enterprise, scientists and scientific research and evidence-based policy, kind of that broad kind of package of ideas and institutions around science. And as I got into this a little farther, and we mentioned one of these things briefly in the paper is there are a bunch of areas where the public is very, very trusting of science. Among all of the major industries and institutions, public institutions, our executive branch, our legislative branch, religion, education, finance, these big institutions, among all of those, science is still today one of the most trusted institutions among the American public. Wow. And by that, we mean the public has more confidence in science than any institution with the exception of the military. Mm-hmm. So it's a very respected institution.
That's good to hear.
Yeah. And it's been fairly stable since we've been tracking it back into the 70s, a slight decline. But there are some kind of, you'd say, some chinks in the armor. There are some weak points. And some of those are well known, that there is a small group of people in the U.S. that are very skeptical of vaccines, for example. That's a technology, we would broadly say, coming out of science and medicine that has clear public benefits. But there's a real skepticism among a small group of people about vaccines. They've been labeled anti-vaxxers.
Yes.
There's this growing group of the public, a segment of the public that's very skeptical of the research on climate change. Mm-hmm.
Is that growing? Did you say?
Yeah, that's a growing one. That's moved as that issue has become kind of folded in or co-opted in as a political issue, that one party is on one side of the issue and the other on another. Then you get kind of, we call it tribal politics, helps to move public opinion. So that's a unique element on climate change that's not present on vaccines. Nuclear power is another one that there's been some durable resistance. But among these areas where the public has just had an unusually high level of skepticism of what science is telling the public, the most extreme outlier, the place where the public is the most skeptical, and by that we mean the least trusting of science, is around GMOs. This is the weakest area, this is the area where the entire scientific enterprise, I would say, is most at threat. And the reason is once we come to doubt an institution on one issue, once that first kind of seed of doubt is planted, then it becomes much easier to germinate and to spread to other areas, because that's kind of the big step is do you just wholly trust or do you kind of selectively trust?
You're
selectively trusting, again, then there's no clear line where you stop.
And so
this is a kind of a serious issue, and it is a really significant one for the scientific enterprise.
Yeah. So the simple heuristic as if science, public trust in science is eroded, beginning with a wedge issue such as GMOs, a simple heuristic for busy people is, oh, you can't trust scientists, you know, because if they have time to investigate things, that's great. But, you know, everybody's busy. We're busy. You and I are busy. So, I can see where we could end up with a substantial fraction of our population that just, you know, chooses to you know, not believe. Or that there's value in the scientific community. So as a sort of a concluding question, do you think, based on what you've seen, that this anti-GMO efforts through the Russian media does it fit with the Russian information warfare strategy that has been described, or is it an outlier?
I want to say, take the middle there and say yes and no. In one sense, it absolutely fits the bill. It looks just like what we're seeing in other areas. Other researchers that have taken on some of these specific topics and more broadly looking at the totality of the information campaign, this looks like it. It's the messaging is purposeful. It's broad-based. It's like classic propaganda. It's highly emotional. It evokes fear. It reaches to kind of our most baseline and elemental emotions and human drives. I mean, it's got all of these classic elements of a real propaganda, you know, information campaign. Mm-hmm. And it mixes a little fact in with a lot of fiction. And again, these are classic elements as well. There's enough truth in there to get people that are on the fence to believe, but then there's a whole bunch of fiction as well to really get people afraid and feeling irrational rather than thinking rationally. So in that sense it is, but the one distinctive is what we've seen, at least the research coming out on some of these other issues like fracking, for example, some of the other divisive issues in the US gun control, the Black Lives Matter movement, some of these issues in the US that are just divisive issues, that are really kind of political and socially divisive issues. We've seen in the Russia campaign, information campaign, that they send pro messages to some groups and anti messages to others, meaning they don't seem to be taking sides with these issues. They take both sides and they try and enliven and amplify the most heated rhetoric and arguments of both sides.
Yeah.
But with GMOs, we're not seeing that. We're not seeing a two-sided or a bimodal attack. We're seeing it's a very one-sided attack, and and by that I mean it's all anti. So in that sense, it's different.
Okay. So I get that. So you can have one way to create sort of that social disruption. I don't know if that's the best phrase, but you might have a better one. But is to just amplify the polar arguments. But in this case, it's all one sided. The amplifying the anti-GMO side. And again, I think that's that head slapping moment because they're just clearly far from dominant. In fact, quite the opposite with respect to genetic engineering.
Yeah.
Once again, even, you know, China and the European Union, where the population is largely anti-GMO, the scientific communities themselves, most experts in the area are actually favorable to the technology used wisely. That it's not like they know anything different and better information than we have. We have the access to the best science worldwide, and they know nothing that we don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, one of the areas where the Russian efforts have really, they've been quite successful and strategic is, you know, because this is such a scientific practice here in the U.S., science in the U.S. is highly specialized. We're trained to be specialists, and we think of it in these very specialized ways. So at this very detailed, I mean, literally the genomics angle is just the most specialized, the most micro level we can get. And sometimes that gets us forgetting that the science that we practice and things like genetic engineering, that those practices operate within a larger social and economic and political context. Yeah. And to the extent that those touch on socially divisive topics or economic insecurities or inequalities, then that can cause people to be skeptical or outright opposed to these very specific scientific technologies, not because of the science itself, but because of how it plays out in these larger contexts. And like I say, Russia's portrayal of GMOs just absolutely plays that to perfection. They really exploit those larger connections. As once this genetic technology has escaped the labs and get out into the real world of politics and society and economy, Russia's portrayal really exploits the mischief that those are perceived to cause and sometimes actually cause.
So I'll make a plug. This is all wonderful commentary. I'll make a plug for social scientists as a natural scientist. My wife is a licensed clinical social worker and brilliant sociologist. And she and other, you know, sources have been very helpful in allowing me to create public outreach programming that is faithful to the science, risks and benefits, but is perceived, is heard by the public. It's not about convincing them to think like I do, but to make sure the public has been exposed to the fundamentals of the pros and cons, risks and benefits. And boy, listeners, if you're a natural scientist and you haven't interfaced with social science literature or social science experts or communicators, it's huge how much of a difference that can make. And so you can contact me for a fact sheet I put together on the topic, a short fact sheet. But yeah, work with social scientists really is important. So I really believe that. So I wanted to make sure we added that to the
podcast. Well, thanks for the plug for the social scientists. Sure. I have to agree.
Is there anything, Sean, is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about the topic?
No, I mean, I think in conclusion, I would just encourage people that are interested in the topic to be very selective in your information sources, that there's a lot of information out there. We've never been exposed to more information as people, as a species than we are at present, just massive exposure. And a lot of it's we should be skeptical. A lot of it's questionable and dubious. And I think it's just a time for people to really vigilant about their news sources is to source these a little bit and to take a little time to make sure that you're getting kind of reliable information from trusted sources.
Wonderful. Well, that's a good way to close. And so, Sean, thank you once again for sharing your insights and your research here on the Talking Biotech podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Talking Biotech. Write a review on iTunes and tell a friend to listen, as your support allows us to deliver more of that exciting science to more people. I'm Paul Pacelli, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.